One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
So Matt, after playing guitar for as many years as I have, I thought, you know, I could learn to play the piano. But I realized that it's not an easy instrument to pick up.
That's pretty good.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales. All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. I'm good. I'm tired.
Yeah.
So,
I know.
I told you what I did today, and you know, I'm tired, but I'm here, and we are gonna make it through without me dozing off. I promise.
I hope so.
God. Yeah. Right.
Wouldn't that be just terrible?
As I'm talking, right into the mic, forehead on the mic. Now, we mentioned this last week, but I want to mention this again. If you listen to us on Apple, please go and make sure that our podcast is auto-downloading, because with this new iOS update, we have stopped seeing the auto-downloads. And, I mean, even if you don't listen to us, just set it to auto-download. That way it's there for when you do get to listen. I mean, you don't have to listen to us on the Friday it drops, but have it auto-download. And then you can listen to it Monday, Tuesday, it'll be there.
Right.
But for some reason, this new iOS update that they did has cut the auto-download from some podcast. Mm. And just make sure that we're still auto-downloading. You may have us in your list.
Yeah, we may still be in your library.
Right.
And I did not say library. In your library. But it may not be pulling the show.
Right.
And so, and understand, you know, that this helps us tremendously. If you've been a listener and we get that download counted, you have no idea how much that means. You may listen to that show 3 weeks late.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. But it really boosts the show, and it keeps us where other people can find us, and it keeps our sponsors happy. So we really appreciate everybody going and checking and make sure they're still doing that.
Yep. Make sure that we're on your auto downloads. We appreciate that very much. Also, if you like hearing Matt and I talk and you're like, there is just not enough of those two country idiots talking. I need more of that.
Say that.
Yeah, there's probably one person
out
there.
A few of you.
But
we know.
Yeah.
We know who you are.
Go over to patreon.com/graveyardtales. Sign up to become a patron. We've got multiple different levels, and all the levels will get a bonus episode every week, the audio version of it. Our $5 and $10, they also get the video version of that episode, and they get the ad-free audio and video versions of our main episode. So if you're $5 or $10 member, you can watch us do both shows ad-free. Also, our $10, on top of all that stuff, they get our second show, Side Quest, So go over there and check it out. If you want to hear Matt and I talk about stuff that's not Graveyard Tales related, this is a little bit of everything. We play games, we talk trash, and it is a little more uncensored than Graveyard Tales is. So
yeah, that's an understatement.
Right. But yeah, go over there, check it out, $1, $5, or $10, and become a patron. Also, when you sign up, we will send out a thank you package with some Graveyard Tales merch in it. So sign up, you can get some Graveyard Tales merch and a thank you letter from me and Matt. And Ashley is the one that packs all those letters and does all the addressing and everything. So thank you, Ashley, for doing that. But if you would like to get some GYT merch, then sign up and we will send some out to you. Plus you get all the bonus stuff.
Yeah.
And also go check out our sponsors. Go down in our show notes, click the link, head over to whatever sponsor tickles your fancy. Use our code, get you a discount, and get something cool with it.
Hello, lover of things that go bump in the night. This is Dan Cummins.
And I'm Lindsay Cummins.
And we co-host the paranormal horror podcast, Scared to Death. Are shadow people real? What about demonic possessions? Poltergeist activity? Do you believe in ghosts? Malevolent entities? Are aliens real? Could you be abducted?
We don't know, but what we do know is that we have over 230 episodes of stories on our podcast, Scared to Death, exploring all of the possibilities.
Each week, we share several supposedly true stories that have been gathered from around the world and submissions from our own fans of allegedly true tales.
Curious about the paranormal? Just like a spooky story? Do you need more fear to fuel you through your long work days?
Come join us. New episodes of Scared to Death are released every Tuesday night. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you end up scared to death.
So, on that note, Matt, why don't you tell us, what are we talking about tonight, brother?
Okay, so tonight we're going to talk about a place that Adam and I have mentioned countless times on the show, but we've never actually focused our research on it specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those places like Easter Island. It's iconic. The images of it, everyone recognizes it. Whether you know anything about it at all, when you see a picture of this place, you immediately know.
Yep.
And that is Stonehenge. And it's just incredible what people have looked into at Stonehenge. What could have possibly gone on there, what goes on there now. And it covers the widest spectrum.
Everything
from ghosts to UFOs can be associated with Stonehenge. And it's funny, I found a quote about Stonehenge that said that scholars say that the builders of Stonehenge, quote, put an enormous effort into this extraordinary structure, despite the fact that it serves no known practical function. And you're kind of like, it served something. Nobody is going to go to this much effort
for nothing.
Like, wouldn't it be cool? No, it wouldn't be cool. You know, for us to do all this work for no reason at all? No.
Yeah.
So the people that put Stonehenge together thousands of years ago, they had a reason. We're going to talk about some theories about what they were doing and, you know, what's going on there now, what possibly went on there thousands of years ago. But just like with any other place, the history of Stonehenge and the area where it is very, it's critical to trying to understand more about Stonehenge. So Adam, tell us about the history of Stonehenge and Salisbury Plain.
All right. I took my ibuprofen, so we're good to go.
Right.
I think I can make it through here. And I do think that the history of Stonehenge in the area might be more pertinent than even other topics that we've covered.
Yeah, I can see that.
But as we always say, go check our sources down at the bottom of the show notes. You can find where we found all the information, and you can keep researching if you get tickled by something that we bring up and you're like, they didn't cover that as much as I would like. Go down in the bottom of our show notes, find the source, and continue learning. We try to source everything that we talk about so that you know we're not just blowing smoke. I mean, because it happens sometimes. People blow smoke. So, but let's talk about Stonehenge. So Stonehenge is located on the Salisbury Plain, like Matt said, which makes me want a hamburger patty soaked in brown gravy for some reason.
It reminds you of like seventh grade lunch, you know?
Yep. Bad TV dinners from the 90s.
Yeah.
The Hungry Man Salisbury steak.
Oh,
you got
yeah.
two of them in there.
Oh, yeah.
Man. Oh, that was a staple for me as a hungry teenage boy. That was my pre-dinner. I'd have a Hungry Man TV dinner before I ate dinner. So, you know, but it's in Wiltshire, England, and it's about 9 miles north of Salisbury and 2 miles west of Amesbury. Now, according to the Online Etymology Dictionary, Stonehenge's name likely comes from the Old English word Stanages, which meant stone gallows. So this name was given to the monument in the 12th century, possibly because of the horizontal lintel stones there with the top stone on top of it, because it looked like an old-style gallows. Some theorists suggest the name might also refer to the stones hanging or supported in the air. But I have also read that a hinge is a ditch and a bank, like the ditch that runs along the outside of the stone monument. So it's Stonehenge because the stones and then the hinge that runs around it. And I mean, maybe a year ago I learned that, but I don't know why it's called a hinge. But if you look at stuff, and I'll talk about something toward the end of my notes that is also a hinge. So I think, in my opinion, the etymology dictionary might be putting a little too much into Old English when it could just be that it's a stone monument surrounded by a hinge, and that's why it's called Stonehenge. But it also could be that the hinge got its name because of the name that it was given. And then they said, oh, well, stone, we're going to break it up, and this is a hinge. I don't know. Whichever came first. But I have read and heard that a hinge is the ditch in a bank. So however you want to take that. Now, the Salisbury Plain was a significant spot for humans a long time before Stonehenge was actually built. Now, as early as 8,500 to 7,000 BC, Mesolithic hunter-gatherers had put up wooden posts around the area. And so they say this shows that there was a reason for them to consider the area important. So, if hunter-gatherers took the time to dig holes and put wooden posts in, there was a reason. It wasn't just, ooh, this is pretty. So it was important to them for some reason, as far back as 8,500 BC.
Right, yeah.
So currently, the area around Stonehenge has wide open expanses of rolling hills, and it's got a chalk subsoil, and the soil in the area is actually pretty nutrient poor. So there's not a lot that grows there naturally without help. And the area, if you look, is treeless. There's not nary a tree in sight. Nary a tree in sight. But if we go back to around 8,500 BCE, Salisbury Plain was actually transitioning out of the last ice age and into warmer, suitable climates for people. and the landscape was predominantly covered by mixed broadleaf forest, including species like oak, elm, ash, alder, lime, and hazel, and the climate warmed. So the forest expanded over what had been just a more open, scrubby land. And they say the higher downlands of Salisbury Plain likely served as upland hunting for Mesolithic groups. And then the river valleys were rich in plant foods and freshwater fish and wildfowl. So it's very different then than it is now.
Yeah, absolutely.
But by this time, people had started returning to the area after the real harsh glacial periods, and they have found scattered flint tools and remains of riverside campsites in the area to kind of prove this. And there's evidence that Mesolithic people began to deliberately clear parts of the forest to attract grazing animals. So this was early forms of landscape management, which if you rely on grazing animals for your food, you're going to figure out how to get more.
Right.
And they figured out if they cleared the land, the grazing animals would come in and then it would be an easier hunt. Mm-hmm. So pretty interesting to me that back then, 8,500 to 7,000 BC, they were already managing the landscape like that.
Right, right.
Now, the Stonehenge area was constructed in several different parts over quite a few years. Scientists and archaeologists think it was constructed over a period of 1,500 years. So from the first time somebody started...
That is a long time to spend
really
on one project like this.
Mm-hmm. And how many generations?
Right.
So
yeah,
you had
that project
to think
manager
about,
would get fired.
Right, right. That, yeah, I mean, but it, they work about as fast as Metro Nashville road crew does. But
yeah, you're not kidding.
I still am bitter toward them from my 15 years in Nashville.
He hadn't even lived here in years, and he's
still bitter about it. Still bitter about it. But there had to have been a grander plan and a grander reason. If 1,500 years is how long it took to get to the final stages, now granted, it went through different metamorphoses, and I'll talk about those. And so the first idea was not, let's put Stonehenge up, and it just took 1,500 years to get the stones there. But there was a reason. This place was so important to these people and subsequent generations that they spent that long doing stuff to this area. Mm-hmm. The archaeologists categorized these into periods, and each period, due to carbon dating, can be fixed to about 100 years or so in accuracy, which is pretty good when we're talking about that many years in the past. Mm-hmm. But the different parts that were done during these periods, they can't really tell the order that they were done in. So they know that these things happened within this 100 years, but they don't know if part A was done first or part B. So it's hard to tell which came first, the chicken or the egg.
Yeah, right.
But you can kind of figure it out. I mean, make an educated guess when you look at some of this stuff. But phase one was the earliest portion of Stonehenge, and it dates to approximately 3,100 BC.
Golly.
Right? It's been around a long time. The first period of Stonehenge was basically a circular enclosure that was outlined by two banks and a ditch with an entrance to the northeast and one standing stone a bit away from the entrance. So the outer circle was made from earth, and even though this is now mostly destroyed, it was about 380 feet in diameter 8 feet wide and 2 or 3 feet high. So even then they had a circle. It was a circular monument.
Right. Which, I mean, you know, that it's hard enough to, you know, draw a circle that's, you know, close.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine trying to construct one, you know,
out of dirt.
Yeah. And you're on ground level. Mm-hmm. And we're talking 380 feet in diameter. I mean, it's a little bit larger than a football field.
Yep.
So if you're standing on one end of a football field and you got your partner or your partner's crew on the other end, further away mm-hmm. even, and you guys are working around and you're trying to go, okay, we're going to go this way and you guys go that way and we're going to make a circle. Yeah. Chances are you're not going to be able to do it, especially without the ability to look down on it from above.
Right. Right. And like you said, just the ability to get a semi-perfect circle mm-hmm. is amazing. Yeah. So there was even at 3100 BC, they had some way of planning this out.
Mm-hmm. Adam, let's take a minute and talk about one of tonight's newest sponsors, Rula. Now, not everybody immediately thinks about going to therapy. You know, you have a rough spot. Maybe you're not feeling yourself, and it doesn't click that maybe I could benefit from going to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is because, you know, you got to find a therapist. You got to make sure they take your insurance, and you got to drive, and you got to make an appointment and everything. And that just, it bogs people down to the point where they just go, forget it.
Right.
Well, Rula helps eliminate all of those blockades to getting actual therapy. You know, finding a good therapist that works with you, making appointments and all of that stuff is so much easier with Rula. I mean, Rula is really on a mission to make high quality mental health care from a licensed professional easy and affordable. And they take most major insurance plans, and the average copay is only about $15 per session.
That's great. So,
yeah, you can now get the quality care you need when you need it, at a price that you can afford.
That's right. And you can find a therapist that's right for you. You know, Rula partners with a network of over 15,000 therapists and psychiatrists nationwide. So it lets you find your personalized solution and get the right therapist for you based on your needs and state requirements and all that kind of stuff. And like Matt said, you pay as little as $15 per session, because they're covered by most major insurances. They have true end-to-end care. So what does that mean? Rula is committed to supporting you and staying with you every step of the way on your mental health journey. You know, from the start of finding a therapist to then helping you schedule appointments and then monitoring your progress, they're really here to help you. And they have a range of care types that, you know, they're not just stuck in one, we only treat this. Mm-hmm. You know, most online therapy platforms focus on connecting clients with licensed therapists, but they fall short a lot when it comes to help with medication management and stuff like that. And Rula has a wide range of licensed professionals, including psychiatrists, who will help you get the care that you need. Now, thousands have already trusted Rula to support them on their journey toward improved mental health and overall well-being. So just head over to Rula.com/grave to get started today. And after you sign up, they ask you where you heard about them. Support our show and please tell them that we sent you.
Yeah, go to Rula.com, Rula.com/grave, G-R-A-V-E. And take the first step towards better mental health today. You deserve quality care from someone who cares.
Now, the ditch, they say it's more like pits, was not perfectly uniform in shape or depth. Mm-hmm. You know, it varied in width from 10 to 20 feet and depth of 4.5 to 7 feet. But considering the size of the circle, that's not bad. That's not a huge variance. They say not much effort was taken in keeping the ditch clean, though. So it's not like they went and cleared it out all the time. Archaeologists have been able to use a bunch of fragments, like picks made of red deer antler and scoops made of oxen shoulder blades, found near the bottom of the ditch to kind of help date its construction. Now, inside the ring, inside the circle, they had put a ring of 56 pits known as Aubrey holes. And they were possibly, they think, for timber posts or smaller stones mm-hmm. to set in. Mm-hmm. Now, phase two, this was from 2900 to 2600 BC. They say evidence suggests that there were timber structures and further post holes that were added. And the site began at this point to be used as a cremation cemetery, making it the earliest known cremation cemetery in the British Isles. Which, I mean, we don't, it's our hubris as modern humans to not think about what they did with the dead that long ago. Mm-hmm. But all cultures and societies have different ways of dealing with the dead. Some bury them, but they apparently were cremating the remains and doing it at this spot. Now, phase three was 2600 to 1600 BC. Now, this is the phase that saw the arrival of the massive stones that we know Stonehenge for today. Around 2500 BC, the builders actually put up a double ring of bluestones that they transported from the Preseli Hills in Wales, which is about 250 kilometers away. And then soon after that, the sarsen stones that weigh up to 25 tons were arranged in the familiar outer circle and inner horseshoe that we know of. And I'll talk in a minute about how they think this was done and get in a little more detail with it. But the bluestones were rearranged several times, and additional features like the avenue, which is the ceremonial pathway that everybody says is aligned with the solstices, was constructed. Mm-hmm. And this avenue being lined with the solstices is what lends to some of the theories about Stonehenge. But there are different stones within Stonehenge, and they're not all the same or from the same origin. So let's look at these. I briefly mentioned them, but we'll look at them a little deeper. Now, the sarsen stones. These are the largest stones, and they're the ones that you see on the outside of the circle and the little horseshoe. Mm-hmm. They were sourced from West Woods on the edge of Wiltshire Marlborough Downs, which is about 15 miles north of Stonehenge. Now, these sarsens, they say, typically weigh between 10 and 30 tons and stand up to 7 meters tall.
That's big and heavy.
Big and heavy. And just the to say, okay, I'm going to go get this. I want this stone
just
here.
Just go pick one of them up for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I got thoughts on how they say they did it, but that's a whole nother thing that I'll get to in a minute. But just the simple fact that these are the stones that we want to do, and they're from this far away,
mm-hmm.
shows a huge importance on this site and this monument. There's also bluestones. Now, the smaller bluestones that the inner circle is made of, they originated from the Pwllheli Hills in Pembrokeshire, Southwest Wales. That's around 140 miles away. So archaeologists excavated different areas, and they've pinpointed specific quarries, such as the Carn Godog. No, I said that wrong because that's a difficult thing. Cairn something. Anyway, that's the source that they think that the spotted dolerite bluestones came from. And there's an altar stone in Stonehenge. And they say recent research has shown that the massive altar stone at the center of Stonehenge came from the Orcadian Basin in northeast Scotland, which is a distance of at least 434 miles from the monument.
Man.
So they say this is the longest known journey for any stone used in Neolithic monuments. So this stone, the altar stone, of the importance of stones, it's obvious that this was an important stone.
Yeah.
To the Neolithic people. Now, according to archaeologists and scientists, how did they move these stones? Because we talk about how big they are and all that. Now, keep in mind that all this is theoretical, and it's based on experiments done by modern-day scientists and archaeologists. So we don't have a blueprint, and we don't have writings for how the ancient people did this. So despite people saying this is how they did it, it's actually just our best assumptions on how they did
right.
it. Right. And you know what they say when you assume.
Yeah.
You make an enemy of exactitude.
Well, I kind of look at it the same way they've come up with theories on how the pyramids were built. We don't know. We don't have any written guide that explained how they did it. But when the way I would look at it, and I'm sure people smarter than I have, done this, but I'm gonna look at it to imagine that I'm gonna do it, but I'm only gonna do it with the tools that I thought they had available to them.
Right.
So to me, there's way too many variables there. Because you're assuming, again, that they had the tools that you would believe they had.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Whether or not the engineering or the ingenuity or any of that comes into play, you make an assumption that they would have A, B, C, and D available to them, and then you're going to try to make it work by using A, B, C, and D.
Right.
Well, they could have had an entire alphabet of tools that we aren't aware of.
Very true.
To make this happen. So again, we're just saying this is how they probably did it because this is how we would have done it.
Right.
But we,
if we had these tools, exactly. That's how we would have done
so,
it.
So again, way too many variables there for us to be accurate.
Right. Right. And like you said, they may have most likely had tools that we don't know of mm-hmm. because we haven't found archaeological evidence of. And they've had how many thousands of years to perfect this transporting?
Yeah. And well, think about the last 1,000 years. I mean, What technology and understanding do we have that we've gained in the last 1,000 years? The last 60 years,
yeah.
I mean, is utterly amazing. And you and I have talked about this many times. You know, how quickly technology advanced. If we're looking at a window of 1,000 years, 1,500 in the case of Stonehenge, how much did they figure out from the time where they started to 1,000 years later that made it easier or better or faster, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's why I say most of this is theoretical, mm-hmm. but it's the best guess we can come up with as the archaeological community looks into it. So the Sarsen stones. Now, these were quote unquote local, but they were huge stones. So they say to move these stones, ancient builders likely used strong wooden sledges pulled over log rollers or wooden tracks. So this is the same theory on the stones at the pyramid. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the pyramids. This is the same theory they said. And this log roller wooden track system, they said, would prevent the heavy stones from sinking into the soft ground. But try it. Just put any stone on one of these things. It'll work. But how difficult is that? But experimental archaeology has shown that teams of people could move massive stones using this method, especially when the ground was lubricated with animal fat to reduce friction.
Huh.
So that's a good idea. But how many of these stones did you move, and from how far away, and how much animal fat did you have?
Well, you had a constant supply because the stone was rolling over the line of people.
That's true. That's true.
Getting crushed by it as they were dragging it along.
That's true. So they just kept lubricating the ground.
They just kept replacing the people at the front of the line. Mm-hmm. They were like, when I get down to about third away from this stone, I'm going to bail out.
Yeah, right, right. I mean, it's the first sacrifice for Stonehenge, first human sacrifice for Stonehenge. But, yes, that is possible and has been proven through experimental archaeological studies. But I had to look at it like, all right, how much animal fat did these people actually have to spare that they weren't eating? Because you need the animal fat to survive winters. But yes, it can be done. But again, I'm on the page of, I don't know if that's how they did it.
Well, we assume too that it was animal fat as a lubricant. What if they figured out something else that was in greater supply that they could use to lubricate the ground?
Something from the plants that they had in the area or something. Yeah. Yep. It's true. Now, the blue stones, these were from Wales. So this was a long distance away. And they say that the journey likely combined land and water routes. So again, talking like the pyramids, they said overland, the stones were probably hauled on sledges and rollers like the Sarsens were. But then once they got to a coast or a navigable river, the stones may have been loaded onto rafts or boats, floated along the Welsh coast, and then up the River Avon toward Salisbury Plain. Waterways and ancient river channels identified by modern LIDAR, they say that rivers played a significant role in the transport process. So, yeah, I can see that. Mm-hmm. But if you're able to get these stones onto a barge, you could then float it. Mm-hmm. But
easier said than done, for sure.
Right, right. Now, how did they, once they got them there, how did they erect the stones and get them to stand up? Well, they say that builders started by digging large, deep holes with a sloping side at the intended location for each stone. Then the back of the hole was reinforced with wooden stakes that would help guide and support the stone as it was raised. The stone was maneuvered into position, they say often using wooden sledges and rollers, to the edge of the pit. Then ropes made from plant fibers and likely a wooden A-frame provided mechanical advantage for pulling the stone upright.
So like raising a barn.
Yeah, a lever system. Mm-hmm. And the stone was tipped into the hole, sometimes they say using a pivot point or ramp to help rotate it into a vertical position. Then weights or levers may have been used to assist in the process, and the stone was rocked or levered upright by teams of people. And then once it was upright, the holes were packed tightly with rubble and earth to secure the stone in place.
I mean, it makes sense.
And yeah, it all, and I'm not trying to poo-poo any of this.
No, yeah. You know, these are legitimate ways.
Yes.
To accomplish this.
I just have to always put in there that this is, like you said, how we assume they did it with what we assume they had, or how we would have done it if we had that stuff. Now, to put the horizontal lintel stones on top, they say timber platforms or ramps were probably made to raise the massive lintel stones to the tops of the upright stones. The builders used advanced joinery techniques, carving mortise holes into the tops of the uprights and corresponding tenons on the lintels that allowed the stones to lock together like woodworking joints. Now, the lintels were slotted together using tongue and groove joints for stability. All right, Matt, so let's talk about one of tonight's sponsors, and that's Ollie. Now, we've talked about Ollie before, but, you know, if you could talk to your dog, and actually, I mean, I talk to my dog, but they don't talk back. That's the problem.
Mine do.
Yeah, man, yours are just smarter than mine. If mine could talk back, they would tell you about just the junk that's in their bowl.
Yeah.
Because most of us give them mass-produced kibble, and they eat it, but they're not as excited as they could be. And Ollie is here to give you the option for nutritious pet food with fresh human-grade meals that are made of the highest quality ingredients. You know, you don't have to worry about what mystery meat is in there and what products are put on there for preservatives. They have 5 fresh protein first recipes, like beef and sweet potatoes and turkey with blueberries. And if you can hear it, I got one of my dad's dogs today, and he's huffing in the background because he hears me talking about food, and he knows that Ollie is great.
Yeah, so just fill out Ollie's 30-second quiz, and they'll create a customized meal plan based on your dog's weight, activity level, and other health info. Now, for any first-timers, Ollie will send out your pup's first box with 2 weeks' worth of meals, a free storage container for mess-free serving, and a guide of how to gradually switch them over to their new diet. More excitement at mealtime, shinier coat, and solid, easy-to-pick-up poops.
That's nice.
I mean,
nice.
Hey, that's the triple crown right there, right?
I'm telling you.
1 to 2 months on Ollie can help dogs reach a healthy weight. And Ollie offers 3 meal plans to choose from. So you can choose between a full fresh plan, fresh topper plan, or a mixed plan with their freshly baked recipes for your special fur baby. They also have treats and supplements. Ollie is the only fresh dog food that comes with unlimited routine health screenings, so you get your pup on track to living their healthiest, happiest life.
And that's important.
That's very important, especially for my dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Dogs deserve the best, and that means fresh, healthy food. Head to Ollie.com/grave, tell them all about your dog, and use our code GRAVE, G-R-A-V-E, to get 60% off your welcome kit when you subscribe today.
Yeah, plus they have a happiness guarantee on the first box. So if you're not completely satisfied, you'll get your money back. But I promise you're going to be completely satisfied, and your dog is too. So that's Ollie, Ollie.com/GRAVE, and enter our code GRAVE to get 60% off your first box. So then the fit of the lintels were carefully adjusted to ensure stability and durability, and the stones were then secured by packing more material around their bases. So we got them all up now, and we've heard Adam poo-poo some of the stuff, but also I have to say again, because I know people are going to say something. Yep, that this is 100% a way that it could be done.
Oh, yeah.
But I think there are other ways that it could have been done that might have been simpler to them or something that they knew. And I'm not going into a crazy conspiracy theory either. You know, I'm not trying to diminish these Neolithic people by saying, you know, they had help from outside sources, but I want people to understand that this is not set in stone, that this is how this was done. Yeah. No pun intended.
Yeah. We don't necessarily think either that some Druids were traveling around in Egypt and saw the pyramids and went like, man, how'd y'all do this? And they're like, yeah, oh, right. We did it like this. And
so let me show
they
you.
Traveled right. back mm-hmm. and said, hey, we figured out a way to do this.
Yeah, we learned something new. Check this out. Now, Stonehenge is what we're discussing today, but the area around Stonehenge has a bunch of different ancient sites that are all thought to tie together. Mm-hmm. So briefly, I want to look at a few of these before Matt takes over here because they're interesting. Now, Woodhenge, and this is what I was saying. This is called Woodhenge. So what I mean, like I was talking about with the hinge being a ditch in a bank, mm-hmm. that's what this is named after, is the hinge. Which came first? I don't know. But Woodhenge is what they say, a Neolithic timber circle that's just 2 miles from Stonehenge. It's marked today by concrete posts that show where massive wooden pillars used to stand. Woodhenge dates to around 2500 BC, and they think it had religious or ceremonial significance. Its proximity and similarity to Stonehenge make it a key part of the wider ritual landscape, mm-hmm. and it kind of shows the diversity of monument types for this area. The Durrington Walls are there. It's a vast Neolithic henge and settlement that's about 2 miles from Stonehenge, and there's archaeological evidence that says it was a major center for feasting and ritual activity and probably housed the builders of Stonehenge. So the Durrington Walls there were probably where the builders of Stonehenge lived. Mm-hmm. Now there's the Stonehenge Curses. Now the Stonehenge Curses is a large linear earthwork north of Stonehenge. It stretches nearly 2 miles, and they say it dates to around 3500 BC. It predates the stone circle and may have served as a ceremonial or processional route. And the curses, along with nearby Barrow cemeteries, reveal the complexity and longevity of the ritual activity in that landscape. Now, the Avebury Henge, it's about 20 miles north of Stonehenge, and it contains the largest megalithic stone circle in the world, dating, they say, from around the same era as Stonehenge. Avebury is part of a wider complex that includes Silbury Hill, West Kennet Long Barrow, and its scale and preservation offer a different perspective on what they say is Neolithic monumentality and community life. So if I'm not mistaken, Avebury Henge, there is a small town, Avebury, that still sits inside of this henge, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, right.
Now, Silbury Hill is the largest prehistoric artificial mound in Europe. It stands about 40 meters tall, and it's located near Avebury, and it was constructed around 2400 to 2300 BC, and they say it required a huge communal effort. The purpose of Silbury Hill is still not known, but they say its size and engineering demonstrate the organizational skills of Neolithic societies. So I didn't doubt the organizational skills of Neolithic societies because they built Stonehenge and they built this whole area. But there's several other Neolithic monuments in that area. So if you're interested in looking into them, you can, like I said, sources in the show notes, and you can keep looking at a few more of these Neolithic sites.
All right. And so with all these different Neolithic sites around Stonehenge, they all have some type of significance. And to be honest, almost every area in Wiltshire has got some paranormal, weird oddities going on, and mm-hmm. Stonehenge included. So we got a lot to cover as far as what weird goes on. So let's start with our bread and butter, Adam. What about ghosts and hauntings around Stonehenge? Yeah. Okay. Now, there's a retired security guard, and he was a retired army vet, a stand-up guy for all practical purposes. And he once told the paranormal author Emma Heard about a weird encounter he had at Stonehenge. He said by day he watched hikers and picnickers, and by night he patrolled the empty site. But on one patrol, he heard disembodied voices whispering and singing from inside the circle. But when he went in there thinking he was going to find some people messing around, there was no one there. There was another time that he glimpsed a shadow man walking among the trilithons. He said, and the humming of stone may sound very poetic, but for him, it was uncanny to hear these sounds. The guard even said he would feel this strange electrical charge or a tingle when he was around the stones, like there was this weird electrical charge in the air.
Really?
So he felt like the monument itself was alive with something unexplained. He said this is something beyond ordinary physics. Now, other veterans have sworn by even more startling encounters. In 1972, two soldiers on night duty at Stonehenge thought it was just a big joke, and their colleagues had been teasing them about a white lady ghost seen gliding by earlier in the week. So this wasn't even like we just made up a story. There was a sighting of this lady earlier in the week when these soldiers were on duty. They laughed it off, thought, yeah, they're just trying to scare us. But one lieutenant laid down on the roof of his Jeep for a nap while his partner stayed awake. Moments later, the guard was startled awake, and in shock, he told his friend, man, you're levitating. And in his daze, the sleeping soldier realized that he was floating several feet above his vehicle.
What?
Yeah. His sleeping guy is just floating, and the guy, he goes, dude, you're levitating.
Lay back down, dude. You're floating away.
What are you dreaming about, man?
Right.
But suddenly gravity came back, and he crashed back down on top of his Jeep.
He must have taken some beam dream powder to sleep that well.
Floating. But both of the soldiers were shaken up, obviously, and they promised never to nap while on duty again. Now, they kept the incident to themselves, and one of them has since passed away. But decades later, they finally the story came out, and a British soldier had literally been airborne at Stonehenge, and they they could not explain it. They never
can explain.
That
is wild.
Yeah. I mean, just absolutely nuts.
First of all, you don't hear many people talk about ghosts at Stonehenge,
right.
Which, I mean, you would think just if you believe in ghosts, this is going to be a place that has them. You know what I mean? With all the history,
yeah, exactly.
And stuff. But we also very rarely, if ever, hear about somebody floating while they sleep.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a new one.
Not heard
crazy.
That before.
I like it.
Now, the trenches and barrows have produced deaths and burials for millennia. So the fact that spirits would be there seems inevitable.
Sure.
And
yep.
Close by is the Dog Hill Barrow, where the local lore still talks about a phantom hound that's on patrol. And Emma Heard, the author we talked about earlier, tells us that there is the ghost of a dog that guards Dog Hill Barrow, an ancient watchdog spirit tied to the land. And likewise, children strolling through at night have claimed to see tiny figures darting between the Sarsen stones, small childlike apparitions running around as if they're playing among the uprights. Now,
that'll freak you out.
A lot of people just dismiss these as trick of the moonlight, or you're kind of letting your imagination get away with you. But you add in the history, cremated bones and funeral pyres that filled the ditch in Neolithic times, and the stories get a little more spooky. And one spooky impression is that the unseen elemental forces that haunt the stones, these nature spirits, are like guardian creatures.
Mm.
And some say that crows on the site act like spirit sentinels. So one visitor even brought a medium to Stonehenge only to learn her friend, far away while laying on her sofa, had been standing at Stonehenge with her. The medium described a sickly woman hovering nearby who turned out to match the absent friend's photo and condition.
Huh.
It's as if the plane had somehow bent space to link them together. And, you know, that does sound unbelievable. But it's one of these many modern accounts, and even people hiking there now still get kind of a shiver, or they smell incense in the wind, and there's no source in sight. Now, no ghost tour of the Salisbury Plain area would be complete without talking about the ghost plane. Plane as in aeroplane. During World War II, four soldiers on exercise were driving towards Stonehenge when something bizarre happened. A tiny biplane darted overhead and smashed into trees right beside them. Now, they started yelling orders, and the warrant officer led the squad into the woods to find survivors, or at least the wreck, but found nothing. No crash, no scrap of metal, not even a sound. And
really?
So, confused, the men turned to leave, but the officer stopped them. In the same clearing, there was now a stone cairn. On it was engraved the names of early airmen, like 1912 era. The very aviators whose monument now stands near the visitor center.
Huh.
So, they're thinking, was this like a wartime vision, kind of like an event that happened during the war? Or was this an actual phantom aircraft, a ghost airplane?
Yeah.
Now, newspaper accounts appeared in 1953, but the mystery remains. A witness who saw a pilot's funeral appear out of thin air. So where this tragedy happened, there was a person that actually saw an apparition of a pilot's funeral.
Really?
Some attribute it to the stress of war. Others say that Salisbury Plains turf is too thin to hide these echoes of the past. Either way, after that night, the soldiers never talked about it again. I mean, it freaked them out. And it would me too.
Well, yeah. That's, man.
I mean, and
I don't even know what to say,
I know. It's crazy, crazy stories. Crazy story. I mean, these are the ones that you don't necessarily think of or hear from Stonehenge.
Yeah, yep. Exactly.
But even today, even in modern times, Stonehenge has a haunted reputation. And security patrols and ghost hunters, they'll tell you of hearing these whispers, these pale figures that, you know, move in between the stones, and this feeling of heavy dread that occurs at midnight. One retired security guard, he confided that he felt like something was watching when the fog would roll in. And visitors often like to play ghost hunters. They bring EMF meters or ghost hunting kits. But skeptics remind us of power lines and hallucinations and all the things that could be reasonable explanations for this stuff. And skeptics note that psychic shadows are a lot easier to see in low light. But you take together the historical loss, folklore, and the ghost stories, it gives kind of this almost electricity to the air around Stonehenge. It's though the stones themselves have become a focus point for the unknown, which kind of welcomes people that believe in this to come to the plain.
Yeah.
I mean, it works kind of like a paranormal magnet.
Well, what is that? What is that place in the U.S. in the desert that everybody says is a mystical place? And there's so many people that get drawn to it for different spiritual and religious activities.
I've heard something. You know what? I'm not 100% sure. I bet if I heard it, I would be like, oh yeah. But I can't come up with it at the moment.
But that's what it makes me think of.
Yeah, that it draws that energy. And sometimes sensitive people are drawn to that energy.
Yep. Yep.
Adam, you know, we all have bad habits.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some bad habits in particular that are much more detrimental to your health than others.
Right.
And they're also a lot tougher to quit. And I know when I first started to try to give up my bad habit.
Booger picking?
Yes. God, it was awful. It was so hard because I was used to having something in my hand. I was used to, you know, putting something in my mouth.
Right.
And that motion, it felt natural. And, you know, traditional ways of stopping those bad habits just weren't cutting it. I wish that I had had Fume back then. Fume is a flavored air device. It's fiddly in your hand. You can put it in your mouth, you can breathe through it, and instead of getting anything that's bad for you, you're getting flavored air.
Right.
And it takes away a lot of those habits that are associated with your bad habit.
Right. I know for me, it really did help me quit mine, because like you said, it's a hand thing. And so when I got the Fume, it's weighted and it's clicky, so it feels substantial in your hand, like you're doing something. You can fiddle with it, because I know for a lot of us that are getting off of that habit, you get kind of fiddly, so it gives you something to fiddle with. Plus, breathing through it, I love the maple pepper flavor, and so that was great, because you're not only getting a great flavor with it, but it's also helping kind of take the place of that. And I was breathing through the fume one day, and my mother-in-law saw it. And she goes, "What is that? What are you doing?" And so I told her about it, and she said, "Can I try it?" I said, "Absolutely." So I let her try it, and she was hooked right then on that. She's like, this is fantastic. This is going to help me. So we bought her one, and she loves the crisp mint flavor, but they've got black licorice and peach blush as well, and several other flavors, but she loves that crisp mint. And I know she uses it because I have bought her the refill packs a few times. So that means she's really using it, but it has helped her get off of a habit that she's had for 40 years.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. And we're all proud of her for doing that. But Fume has already helped over 400,000 people take steps toward better habits. And it's your turn now. So if you're wanting to quit a bad habit, just use our code TAILS to get a free gift with your journey pack. So head over to tryfume.com and enter our code TAILS, T-A-L-E-S.
Yeah, head to tryfume.com. That's T-R-Y-F-U-M.com. And use our promo code TAILS to claim this limited time offer today. Now, ghostly sightings aside, many people describe a certain vibe at Stonehenge that you can feel. There's tingling sensations like that security guard had. People get chills, or they almost experience this ecstatic high.
He's got the tingles.
But this almost like euphoria that people get while they're standing on the inner turf. Tourists will come in and hug the stones, they'll meditate, and they report that they suddenly get goosebumps. I think I would get goosebumps visiting Stonehenge because I would go, "Hey, you're at Stonehenge."
Yeah, right, you know, right.
It'd be me, though.
There'd be another reason, but I'd still have goosebumps. Yeah.
But one man's testimony, the BBC noted, was that the whole energy of the space is good. And he was speaking of that feeling he got when he watched the sunrise from Stonehenge. Another visitor. Yeah.
That would be cool to get to watch the sunrise at Stonehenge. Yeah. That'd be cool.
You've seen photos of it. I mean, you know, it is quite breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
But another visitor said she felt profound vibrations underfoot as if the ground just hummed with life. And English Heritage even permits people to sleep inside the circle on the solstice. Because so many swear by the stone's restorative power.
Yeah, well, also, but they allow it because they're going to do it anyway. And they would rather just permit it than try to fight off hundreds of people.
Think, you know, as long as everybody is behaving themselves, you know why? I think it's a great thing to let people do this.
Right.
But the question is why? You know, what are they feeling and what are they experiencing? And sometimes the local research says there's a subtle magnetism about the earth in this spot, or maybe our own minds are tuned in by the circle's geometry. You know, something, you know, ancient geometry was a pretty incredible thing. I mean, you think about it, people that followed Pythagoras, they were almost like a secret society. And in fact, they were, you know, they used that pentagram that has all of those golden ratios and everything about it, as their symbol. So, I mean, you know, there is something to it, that there was this idea that there was some mysticism going on. And for us, it's just math, but it's fascinating math. It really, when you dig into that, it boggles the mind. And again, that power of that circle and the way it's done, it was more than just, let's make this round.
Yeah. You know? And in talking about that and where it sits, I had to look it up real quick because I looked it up before and didn't put it in my notes. But we've talked about ley lines. Oh, yeah. And we mentioned Stonehenge when we talked about ley lines. But that may have something to do with the energy that people feel. And what I looked up was the ley line that it supposedly sits on is the St. Michael line. And it apparently connects a bunch of different sites across Britain. So some of the ones that I discussed all sit on this St. Michael's line.
And
maybe that's the energy that they're feeling.
And I'm going to talk about that here in just a few minutes about a little bit more about those ley lines. But you're right on track. But you know, going back to this circular formation, some modern mystics believe that Stonehenge is an energy vortex. And a lot of people think that energy vortex term is just a lot of mumbo jumbo. Scientists do say that the area is geologically unique. You know, the stones are bluestone and sandstone sitting on chalk uplands. Paranormal researcher Paul Devereaux has long suggested that seismic stresses in the earth underneath these power spots can produce glowing orbs and static energy on the surface. And photographers sometimes get unexplained orbs in their Stonehenge shots, or streaks of light that were not visible to the eye. And Devereaux calls these earth lights, these flashes of electricity in quartz-bearing rocks. And remember when we talked to Derek Hall about all the quartz that was out in the California desert? You know, it was just everywhere. He's like, you know, it wasn't a matter of, oh, well, we find some quartz. It's like, you can't help but find it. It's all over the place. And the energy that quartz can hold. I mean, it can hold an electrical charge, for crying out loud.
Yeah, your watch, phone, computer, none of that would work without quartz.
And so some people think, okay. So if seen in the dark, these orbs or these light flashes or streaks of light could easily be interpreted as spirits or UFOs. So he's saying because of the quartz and because of the characteristics of quartz, that it can produce these lights, and that may be where the whole UFO spirit thing comes from. But there's a perfectly scientific explanation for it.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I agree. Yep. Yes. Because of the quartz and what they do. But you could also do the transverse of that. And that they're there because the quartz are there.
Yeah, that it was brought there for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
I can't talk. There's too many W's in this. The Weird Wiltshire blog.
Yeah, say that 10 visitors, times fast.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm not even going to try it. I'm not even going to say it again. It recounts visitors feeling prickles on the back of the neck and sudden emotions as if someone unseen had just brushed past them. And we just talked about another place that had something similar.
Mm-hmm.
The Druids and pagans casually call it an energy temple. Skeptical scientists say it's likely due to suggestion. Like, if you expect it to happen, it will. But with the sun and shadow playing across these stones and 360 degrees of empty sky, it's hard not to feel kind of like a speck in the universe when you're there.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. And maybe the people who light candles and play flutes have a point. Stonehenge can feel as much spiritual as it does an empty field.
Yeah.
So, outside of official ceremonies, many church groups and neo-pagan tourists come quietly to recharge. Guides have seen pilgrims fall to their knees as dawn breaks. You know, again, watching the sunrise at Stonehenge.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that would be an experience. The ancient people who built it certainly noticed the sun's path. And in a strange loop, thousands of years later, modern humans stand in that same alignment and they claim to catch a little bit of magic.
Sure. But I mean, there's a reason that they built it the way they did.
Exactly. Exactly. There's too much that just falls into place for it to be by accident.
Right. Right.
You know, there was too much work that went into it for it to just be, this is pretty.
1,500 years on the same spot.
This spot's nice. Yeah. Uh-uh.
After about 1,500 minutes, if it wasn't special, you'd give up. You'd be, well, we could do the same thing over here.
Yeah,
this is easier. And stones are easier to put over here. And
we don't have to go that far to get these stones.
Right,
we can
really
use these over here.
Do we need to? We can make the stones smaller.
There was a reason. There's a reason they wanted those blue stones.
Mm-hmm. It just needs to be a foot, right? We don't have to get
we don't have to be gigantic.
We can get the tiny little ones and mini hinge.
I wonder if there is one. Like a mini hinge somewhere.
We made
this model.
Yeah.
We're going to make a bigger version of it.
I have seen people, like pictures of people that have recreated Stonehenge in their yard. So there's new versions of Minihenge. Maybe they did do an old test run of Minihenge. They called
it
Pebblehenge.
Uh-huh. We'll make a small one. It'll be a lot easier. It's like when they show a new football stadium, and they're like, well, we're going to build a little model of it. Look at this. It's got little people out here and everything. One meteorologist pointed out that on the Great Altar Stone at Midsummer, there's often a faint electrical charge in the air, just enough to make your hair stand on end.
You know,
you've seen those pictures of people whose hair stand on end. They're like, these people are about to get struck by lightning.
Yeah, right.
You know, but if there's a field, believers say it was the builders who were testing and harnessing it, placing the stone where the sunlight and the ley lines converge to capture that energy. They're smarter than we think.
Yeah. Yep.
Now we touched on this, but let's talk about it a little bit more. The solstices and the sacred celebrations.
Okay.
And Stonehenge is a magnet for these seasonal gatherings. Each summer and winter solstice, thousands go out in the night to meet the sunrise between the stones. On the longest day of the year, it's an almost mystical crowd. Druids, pagans, hippies, local residents and tourists, they all come together to greet the dawn. Waxy candles, bonfires, and roaring acoustics turn the ruined temple into a bonanza of celebration. And yes, real druids, not of the modern neo-druid type, weave through the crowd clad in white robes.
Huh.
So there's some still around.
Yep.
Now, the Association of Chief Sites Guard note that Stonehenge is built for this moment. In fact, the heel stone off to the northeast lines up exactly so that on midsummer morning, the sun rises just beside it, sending a golden pathway into the very center of the circle.
Hmm.
Witnesses describe a chill as the sunlight finally kisses those gray stones. So it's no accident archaeologists have long agreed that the entire layout was designed in relation to the solstices.
Yeah.
The events are just too strong to deny.
Right.
I mean, it was made for these days.
Yep. Now, if you bring this up in a minute, I'll cut this out. But I was hearing a guy that had studied, I think he's part of that Stonehenge, English Heritage. That's it. English Heritage thing. He was talking about the midwinter solstice lining up as well, but not the sun, the moon. So it was not only for the warmest, prettiest day of the year, but they were also doing the coldest part of the year before it started warming back up.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting to me.
It is just amazing. And you want to hear something even more amazing?
Probably.
So the summer solstice that occurred after the COVID lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They said by dawn, when it opened back up, more than 6,000 people had gathered around that circle. And they welcomed everybody back from the years of pandemic closure. They said there were families, backpackers, 21st birthday tourists from Canada. And when the sun finally peaked out at 4:49 BST, is that British Standard Time?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
That's dang early though.
Yeah. The crowd erupted into cheers and hugs and guitar strums and chanting. People hugged the stones and hugged one another, calling it a profound experience. And one runner described Stonehenge as a temple that unites people each solstice. So even now, it is an amazing place.
Mm-hmm.
And people are just continuously drawn to it. Now, during the winter solstice, it is quieter but equally reverent, and the short December days, it gets dark early, but pagans still brave the cold to welcome the returning light.
Yep.
Druids often play drums or blow horns. The exact rituals vary year by year and by group, but a sense of renewal is always there. But it says no one checks birth certificates at the barrow in the morning. Your confidence that the dead are restless or the stones are alive doesn't matter. You just feel that something's happening.
Yeah.
So, Adam, you know, we've been talking about this and what it does, what the events of the solstice. But when you walk into the center circle of Stonehenge, you're really standing in a primitive star chart.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And English Heritage explains that the builders carefully placed the great sarsens so that they line up with the sun. And as we already talked about, the midsummer sunrise pierces the hillstone. On midwinter's day, the sunset once slipped between the trilithon lintels. And you can see why the ancestors may have thought that this cosmic dance of the heavens was all for them.
Sure.
In fact, archaeologists describe Stonehenge as one of the best Neolithic observatories in the world, a deliberate calendar in stone. And surveys have shown the stones framing that solstice axis were shaped with and oriented with precision. The two lost partner stones of the Healstone would have bracketed the sunrise perfectly. And on the shorter side, midwinter's rays once fell right down the same line, touching the altar stone at sunset. The moon also plays a part in Stonehenge. Archaeologists believe that the station stones and Aubrey holes line up with the moon's 18.6-year cycle. At the lunar major standstill, which is the 18.6-year peak, the most extreme moonrise would have risen in the same gap where bones and posts were laying in the bank.
Huh.
So in other words, the builders may have been tracking not just the sun, but also the northern moon at its lowest ebb.
Yep.
Practically, this would mean that they could predict eclipses and seasons. Spiritually, it might have symbolized a cosmic memory, especially of the cremated dead that were buried facing that moonrise. Imagine a circle of stones where both the sun and moon had their stages, and they mingled together with these earthly ancestors.
Yeah, you can see how much reverence they had for the site just by looking at what we know today.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine how magical it would have been then with no light pollution, no disturbance. You know, you watch the stars come across the sky all night and then the sun rises. And I mean, it's just magical.
Yeah. And so to hit a point that you mentioned earlier with the ley lines, if the celestial alignment tied Stonehenge to the sky, the ley lines tie it to the earth. And, you know, ley lines are a modern idea. Supposedly these invisible energy currents that crisscross the planet and they connect other ancient sites. I mean, ley lines are connected with Easter Island, the pyramids, Machu Picchu, Göbekli Tepe, all these places. They have corresponding ley lines that are near or there. And especially like when you look at, when we talked about the ancient Ram Inn, and how haunted that place is, that is the same ley line that Stonehenge is on.
Yep.
Okay. So yeah, a lot of these places where these oddities occur, all occur along a ley line.
Yep.
Because you know, if you open up your mind a little bit and you think about ghosts, you know, those spirits need the energy, and that's where a lot of the earth energy is concentrated. I'm not going to go into a bunch about how they determined what ley lines were, but, you know, so many people, you know, from the 1920s to the modern times, they feel like these ley lines have some kind of spiritual or even alien power. 1969's The View Over Atlantis. So ley lines were routes into extraordinary interplanetary world between worlds. In other words, anything Stonehenge could do, from astronomy to ghosts, ley lines and UFOs would amplify it. Okay. And today the myth persists.
Yeah.
Journalistic sources have noted that Stonehenge, Glastonbury Tor, and other British ley line hubs roughly lie on a straight line across the landscape. NPR pointed out that Stonehenge and Glastonbury supposedly lay on ley lines, and that mystical energy makes connections all across the UK. And so this means that Stonehenge isn't just aligned with the sun, but also with the subtle, quote-unquote, dragon currents of the earth. And some pagans walk those lines, thinking them like meridians in the body. You know, if you talk about Eastern medicine and acupuncture, you know, there's these meridians or lines that go from one end of the body to the other, and everything along that line is connected. Now, there's really no measurable science to ley lines, but they've really taken on a life of their own in local lore. For example, Druids and hippies often mention ley lines that connect Stonehenge and Avebury. I'm probably saying that wrong. But it's a line that roughly follows the Ridgeway Path at Stonehenge solstices when reporters observe hippies and Druids together. One editor said that it's no coincidence that the Glastonbury Festival opens the same day and they're both supposedly on ley lines. So Glastonbury Tor, Stonehenge, and Avebury do form almost a straight line on the map. It's kind of like finding constellations on Google Earth. Okay. But you're just, you know, instead of looking at the sky, you're looking at the earth, and you can see these patterns emerge.
Right.
Now, Stonehenge's esoteric reputation even includes, as I mentioned earlier, UFOs.
Yep.
Salisbury Plain, the flat expanse around the stones, has a storied UFO history. In the 1960s and 70s, the nearby town of Warminster became infamous for nightly lights and saucer sightings. Time magazine relayed how some of the UK's most impassioned UFO watchers gather atop the nearby Cradle Hill in the belief that they can signal extraterrestrial spaceships. At one point, Warminster had so many UFO reports that locals called it Britain's Area 51. And it's still a hotspot for skywatchers. And since Stonehenge is only a few miles away, a fringe group asked whether the area's ancient mysteries and modern lights are related. And photographs really fuel the rumors. So now and then, a visitor claims to have snapped a silver disc over the hinge. The Express even ran an exclusive, an alleged UFO hover captured on video over Stonehenge. You can see those things all the time now.
Yeah.
And I know they're AI, but man, they look they look exactly like I would expect it to look. I can tell you that. Right. Enough to make me go, man, I want to believe this. But these things, they're impossible to verify. And skeptics blame helicopters and weather balloons or lens flares. But the stories keep coming. Yeah, owls, yeah. But fringe historians love to link Stonehenge with alien lore. For example, one Stonehenge tourism blog points out that in pop culture, the site is often an alien portal. And Stanley Kubrick's film 2001, A Space Odyssey, features a monolith that is a gateway. You know, the dum 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 dum, and that thing is spinning, that big giant stone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And a 1970s TV drama staged a Stonehenge-like circle as a conduit for sinister alien intelligences. You may remember this, Adam. The Star Trek episode, The City on the Edge of Forever, where Kirk leaps through a giant stone hold like a gateway. The takeaway is the image of Stonehenge has been woven into UFO folklore, whether there actually is any UFOs or not.
Right.
It's got a connection.
Well, you talk to anybody about Stonehenge. If you talk to enough people, you're going to get somebody very quickly that mentions UFOs.
Yeah.
Or that it was built by UFOs.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And that goes to this, Stonehenge is some kind of portal. And whenever we talk about portals, whether it's Bermuda Triangle, whether it's the Bridgewater Triangle, any of these areas where they say it could be a portal, UFOs always come into it.
Yep.
You know, whether it's ghosts, whether it's, you know, mystery lights, Bigfoot, UFOs always come up when we're talking about these quote unquote portals.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the fact that Stonehenge is viewed as a portal shouldn't be a surprise to anyone, and how they connect it to UFOs, you know, they like to think that Stonehenge may be a gate to another dimension. And if you think, people say if Stonehenge can align with the sun, why not a parallel universe? You know, science fiction's already done it. There's been films and TV shows. my tongue is getting twisted. Where Stonehenge, or something that resembles Stonehenge, is like a gateway to Saturn, you know, or Lemuria. Right. And the ancient aliens TV show, they love it. They always bring up Stonehenge. And most of the time, archaeologists just chalk it up to too much caffeine and leg cramps. You know, if the stones are like a big magnet, you know, I believe, it's got some physical properties, and these UFOs, or I'm going to be abducted. I can feel them. You know, they're like, no, you just need to, you know, cut back on the Red Bull. You know, who knows? But there's even cryptids that have been discussed here. Emma Heard's research found one report of a Bigfoot-type creature seen lingering around in the fields near the Henge. Now, there's no film or scientific survey that exists of this, just a handful of anecdotal claims. But the idea is if the stones have guardians, Maybe one of them is a giant, mysterious ape man. Or a throwback to the megalith builders. But, you know, with no, there's no proof of any of this. You know, UFO bases or time gates or even Sasquatch at Stonehenge. But the ideas persist because Stonehenge itself is like a storybook. I mean, so many people have put time and emotion and writings and song and poetry into it that it's taken on a life of its own. Whether there's good scientific explanation for the lights and, you know, the activity and how it lines up with the sun and the moon or not, you know, humans on this planet, you know, look at it as whatever it was for, it's mystical and the powers persist. So, you know, when we started looking into this, I was like, I thought I'd find a few ghost stories and maybe figure out some things about what happens there on the solstices. I never dreamed that we would find this much information about Stonehenge. And I never thought about how near and dear it was to the people, you know, not only of that area, but all over the world.
Right.
You know, regardless, I mean, you know, there is something spiritual about it, and it does. It makes you wonder, you know, what did those ancient builders have in mind when they put this thing together?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what did they understand about not just the earth, but the sun and the moon?
Yeah. I want to know, like, why that specific area? What drew them initially to this part of the Salisbury Plain,
right?
To spend that much time and effort into building Stonehenge there. You know, over the research that we've done and just some of the stuff I've watched on it and everything, I've come to believe that it was a very important cremation site for their religious beliefs. That it may go deeper than that, but it, you know, there's so much evidence of cremations and burials there and those types of practices. But what else it tied into, I don't know. But it's one of those places that you can speculate for days about, but guarantee somebody's already speculated the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's been such a mystery, and I'm just glad that it still stands,
right,
and that we're able to still speculate about it and come up with these wild theories of UFOs and everything, and be able to discuss it, do an episode on it, because it is a mystery. I love mysteries. I wish I knew the answer to all the mysteries, but that's a whole nother thing.
It wouldn't be as much fun to talk about then.
That's a good point. Yeah. We'd be done in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Here's a question. Here's the answer. We'll see you next week.
Exactly.
But what do you guys think? I mean, like I said at the beginning of the show, you see, you know, just an image of Stonehenge, you automatically know what it is. You may not necessarily know much about it, but you recognize it.
Hopefully, and you know more now.
Yeah. I know I do. I know
I do
more.
I didn't know all the paranormal stuff.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, I had no idea. They don't talk about it like the other, like UFO theories. Everybody knows UFO stuff, but the paranormal stories that you told, you don't hear that often,
if ever. You don't. And especially when you consider that it's coming from soldiers and security guards.
Right.
And people that you wouldn't imagine are going to make this stuff up.
Yeah.
You know,
and especially about that place, because it's already people think you're kooky if you have ideas about it. So if you're a soldier and you start telling something that happened to you at Stonehenge, they're going to go, okay, Sure, you were levitating. Sure.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But let us know what you think. What do you feel that Stonehenge is and represents? Let us know. And the best place to do that is in our Facebook group. You get in there and you can talk about, you know, whatever topic we're on episode-wise. You can, you know, give responses to these questions. Tell us what you think. You know, you can share some jokes and just it's all around good time. So check it out. Don't forget to check out our website, which is graveyardpodcast.com. And there you can find links to purchase some Graveyard Tales merchandise. You can also listen to the show, and that is where you can become a patron and get access to all of that bonus content. Regardless of what level you sign up for, there is a ton of stuff for mm-hmm. you there, and you're helping the show. And so we appreciate it. Please don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. It brings us up the chart. And as Adam mentioned at the top, go back and check. Make sure that your podcatcher is downloading the episode and you're getting it every week, regardless of when you come back to us. Whew. Man, there's a lot yeah, right. tonight. Until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.